Welcome to the Inside Out Show. I'm Devin Almonte, and together we are learning to see the world through God's eyes, doing our best to live that out in our everyday. Every Thursday here, we take a look at the stories that are shaping our world, the funny, the feel-good, the frustrating, and the faith-enhancing. It's a bit of faith, culture, real life, all delivered with warm clarity and a bit of humor. This is Inside Out Thursday edition. Welcome. Today, we're talking about trust, temptation, some of the quiet ways we test what we already know to be true. We're going to be starting with a story that unfolded in front of a vending machine. Very persuasive son of mine wanted me to get something out of there for him, but there was a warning in front of it that prevented us from doing that. And then we're going to jump into something I know we have all faced at some point. That would be the unwanted subscription charges that are taking over our life. Everything is under this subscription model. And it's very hard to manage this. We've got all our streaming services. We have things that we use for work. We have other kids' programs, all these things that we can't even remember if we canceled or not. And finally, we'll look at the much bigger system that is in the news now, the food stamp issue, SNAP benefits, that it's, I mean, all of this, our welfare system affects all of us in big ways. Meant to help. I think it started with good intentions, but it's become much more of a trap and a burden for many. So let's get started today with our anchor point. A couple of weeks ago, my son and I were standing in front of a vending machine, one of those really sleek ones that the snacks all look amazing and it just makes you want to get something, which is why we were standing in front of this thing. And naturally, my son wanted something. But right where you put your dollar in or the credit card in, it had a piece of paper just taped to it that said, out of order. Now, I think most people would take that as a sign to walk away. But of course, my son's looking at it and he goes, well, can we try it anyway? I was actually also curious about this because the machine looked fine. It was on. It's showing how much each little snack costs. It looked like it was working. And so I'm thinking, this doesn't look broken. What if the sign is old? Or what if it's wrong and it actually does work? I wanted to know. Now, why do we do that? Why are we so tempted to ignore the signs, to test the boundaries, even when the warning is right in front of us, stated clearly? I guess it's because when I'm looking at this thing that looks right, looks like it's working, feels right in the moment, I'm starting to doubt that instruction. Our little vending machine moment here was like a little Garden of Eden. Back in Genesis 3, God gave Adam and Eve clear guideline, clear boundary. Don't eat from that tree. Kind of like saying, nope, it's out of order. And there's Eve standing right in front of it. This tree in all its glory. Looked good. Looked like it's working. Didn't seem dangerous. And then if we know the story, we know what happens. The serpent shows up, kind of comes on in and slithers in. Do you really think that's the case? Did God really say that? Are you sure this is off limits? Doesn't look broken. Eve knew the boundary, and she also had the warning. But the fruit looked fine, the tree looked normal, and so that's all it took. Her curiosity, trusting her judgment over God's, also the deceit of the serpent, that was enough to just have her push and test this boundary. Where has God put up an out-of-order sign in front of you? A clear, don't go there, not this path, wait on this kind of sign. God's warnings are often very clear, meaning he'll show us those warnings, like put them out in front of us. But when we have that warning in the midst of everything looking normal or good for us, that is where I think we start to negotiate that, well, maybe that's not really a serious warning because this looks okay. Maybe next time it'll work. Maybe the sign doesn't even apply to me. God's boundaries are not randomly placed. They're not mistakes. And I don't think he puts up signs to keep us from something good. He's putting that there to protect us and to keep us flourishing. His word still stands, even when we're tempted to test if his instructions really apply and are meant to be followed. And in my case, with this vending machine, I'm $2 poorer and nothing to show for it. All right, now let's go ahead and move into trust, the kind that we give a little too easily. It's the kind that we lose too quickly. And sometimes we have to relearn the hard way. At least I do. I'm talking about our monthly subscriptions that have taken over our life and the world, from our streaming, our gym memberships, the apps, all of it. We get sucked into it. Maybe we cancel, but we find out that we are still being charged month to month to month to month to month. And hopefully we catch it on month one and not 8 months later, which can happen to a lot of people, sometimes even a year later. There was a car wash I used while we were visiting family for a few weeks over the summer. And they had one of those monthly membership plans. And I was like, do I do this? Do I not? Because of course they get you, they charge you a fortune just to wash your car once. And as long as you do it maybe 2-3 times, it's better to get the monthly. So I did that, told the guy, look, just 1 month. I'm not from here. Don't want to sign up for anything else. I even paid extra for the 1 month option so that I didn't sign on for a 6 month, year long service thing. But of course, a month later, ding. Another charge and then another charge. And so now started this whole chase. I had to call them, email them. I'm waiting, repeat the whole thing, call them, email again. Finally, somebody does get back to me and very nice, left this message. Oh yeah, no worries, silly lady. We canceled that for you. I hope that helps. And let me figure out how we can help you get your money back for those 2 extra months that we stole from you. I mean, accidentally charged you for. And if you want a refund, you know, it's very easy. You just contact your bank and you dispute it. It's the easiest way to do it. They'll be glad to help you. Have a great day. That was the message. But okay, easiest for who? Because I'm pretty sure I didn't accidentally charge myself for this. They made the mistake. It's like they made the big mess. And then they say, oh, by the way, Amazon sells this really amazing mop that will help you clean that up. And I'm happy to send you the link. I hope this is helpful. No, that's not the response I want. This is not right. They are trying to make fraud friendly and nice sounding. They are gaslighting me into thinking that they are some sort of saving grace here when it's fraud. I mean, maybe what I would call secondary fraud. They know exactly what they're doing. They are banking on me being tired, distracted, might not even notice that the charges are coming through. And we're not the only one. A Bankrate survey found that 51% of U.S. adults with a subscription or membership account have been hit with unwanted charges, often from little gimmicks like my car wash thing or a free trial that just rolls into a paid plan that we're not aware of. That's not a mistake. It's a strategy. And plenty of companies stretch the rules like the car wash here. So if you have ever found yourself wasting time chasing down your own money, just know it's not you and no, it's not normal. And I don't think we should just accept it as part of life and the cost of doing business. But here's what I've learned. We do have to be fully aware of what we are signing on to. And in this case, I was, and I still got taken for a ride. Never hand your card over for these one-time deals without getting it in writing, clarifying things up front, and always, always, always check your bank account the next month. I mean, we should be doing this anyway, but I know a lot of people, we've got these auto pays and things and you're not really paying close attention. Make sure you got a list of all these services and subscriptions that you've signed up for because these companies know our behavior. They count on us being distracted. So let's prevent it before it happens. Now let's take a look at what happens when the system itself starts to break our trust. That's what we're going to talk about in our main story today. Kim turned down a new job, and it wasn't because she didn't want it, not because she wasn't qualified, but because taking it would have made her family poorer. Let me explain. Kim is a single mom in Chicago. She has 2 kids, 10-year-old, 3-year-old. She works full-time at a retail store. She makes about $30,000 a year. So that's kind of around $15 an hour. Because of her lower income, she qualifies for programs like food assistance, childcare help, Medicaid, tax credits, things like that. And altogether, those benefits are worth about $35,000 a year. So that means between her paycheck and that program support, her family now lives on roughly $65,000 worth of support and income. Not too bad. Not wealthy, but definitely steady. The bills are getting paid. There's food on the table. Kim can breathe a little bit. But her kids are growing, of course, and her needs are changing as things do in life. And she wanted better opportunities. So she landed a new job making about $45,000 a year. Better hours, better pay, closer to home. All of that is fantastic. But when she does the math, it's not so great. By earning more, she loses most of her benefits, the childcare help, the food assistance, even her healthcare. But in the end, that new job would leave her about $10,000, $15,000 less to live on than before. So she said no, she turned down the job. And not because she's lazy, not because she doesn't want to work or want better opportunities. It's because the welfare system makes it almost impossible to move forward without falling behind. And so we end up in this cycle of dependency. You can't get out of it. And here's what also seems really unfair when we look at this from another side. Kim has a coworker, Jessica. She was making $45,000 a year to start. Remember, Kim was at around $30,000. Jessica works just as hard. She's raising her kids as well, but she doesn't qualify for any of the help that Kim gets at a lesser salary. So it's Kim, who is on welfare, who has the better standard of living. This is so backwards. We see that doing the right thing makes life a whole lot harder. How on earth did we get here? Now, Kim and Jessica are not real people. I totally made that up, but their stories are real. The problems we are facing with our welfare programs. Here's what we're dealing with today. We have, I think, around 80 federal welfare programs. I think your child care credits, SNAP, college support, job training. There are so many that are lumped into this. Sometimes there's crossover between different programs. And it's costing us over $1 trillion a year to maintain these programs. Also, to put it in perspective, about 1 in 3 Americans receive some kind of income-based government assistance, programs that are helping people whose earnings fall below a certain level. I don't know. I think these programs started with good intentions. I mean, we can go way back when Franklin Roosevelt created Social Security back in the 30s. He called it security against the hazards and vicissitudes of life.
We can never insure 100% of the population against 100% of the hazards and vicissitudes of life, but we have tried to frame a law which will give some measure of protection to the average citizen and to his family against the loss of a job and against poverty-stricken old age.
That Social Security was really created as a safety net, a way to help people who couldn't work anymore because of age and disability or lose a spouse, that kind of thing. So a nice backup plan should something unfortunate happen. Definitely not to maintain your standard of living. Then in the 1960s, we had Lyndon Johnson, who said, let's expand welfare, like did so dramatically, thinking that these programs could, I think he had the idea that, hey, let's not just help people, let's eliminate poverty entirely. He said, quote, our aim is not only to relieve the symptom of poverty, but to cure it, and above all, to prevent it. Good intentions, I suppose, but then life happens, unexpected things happen, and instead of eliminating poverty, the entire system began to manage poverty. So it became more of a poverty management system. Reagan and the Bushes come in. They saw things differently. They thought welfare should empower, not entrap. Reagan said the best social program is a job. So the focus was on work and responsibility, community-based help instead of all this government control. And then by 1996, former President Clinton said welfare should be a second chance, not a way of life. And he ended up signing welfare reform into law.
When I ran for president 4 years ago, I pledge to end welfare as we know it. Today, the Congress will vote on legislation that gives us a chance to live up to that promise, to transform a broken system that traps too many people in a cycle of dependence to one that emphasizes work and independence. to give people on welfare a chance to draw a paycheck, not a welfare check. It gives us a better chance to give those on welfare what we want for all families in America, the opportunity to succeed at home and at work. A long time ago, I concluded that the current welfare system undermines the basic values of work, responsibility, and family, trapping generation after generation in dependency and hurting the very people it was designed to help. Today, we have an historic opportunity to make welfare what it was meant to be, a second chance, not a way of life.
And for a while, all of that seemed to be working. There was actually a 60% drop for people on welfare, which is huge. And so there was this sense that, oh, okay, the system's doing what it's meant to do. This is a good thing. But again, life happens. I think, you know, the cracks start to show in that a little bit too. The economy changes, costs rise, life gets a little more complicated. Now, if you had to take a guess, how many people do you think have gotten off welfare and stayed off? I don't think we actually know how many people move off welfare and stay off for good. I mean, we sort of do, but the data's a mess because you got multiple agencies and states, people hopping back on one program and then another program, then they're off this one, back on that one. So it's not just an easy number that we can find, but there is some research that shows it's quite low, maybe somewhere between 10 and 20% of long-term welfare recipients become fully self-sufficient within several years of coming off welfare. So the system doesn't really save people from destitution. It's managing their survival. And I think it's gone way far beyond what it was ever intended to be, what it was meant to do, because it's not just keeping people fed in some cases. And I say this carefully because I know there are a lot of people really struggling. But the way the system is set up, it's made life comfortable enough that any progress forward or kind of reaching out and doing things on our own feels like an option rather than something that we need to do. Again, not in all cases, but I do think we definitely see some of that, even with our food stamps. The things that we can buy with EBT are far beyond our basic nutritional needs. It reminds me when we do too much for our kids, because the more that we step in and manage things, the slower they are going to be to step up. And I think that safety net becomes much more than that. It's a cushion. And when that happens, it's very hard to climb out of that. But that is just a small part of it, because there are also people that really desperately want that. They want to get out of their situation. They want to get out of the mess, and they are trying. But the system itself, which is meant to help them, is what is actually hurting them and holding them back. Here's a woman who's on disability sharing that exact struggle, just wanting to do the right thing. She wants to work, to be self-sufficient, but she realizes that it's actually going to cost her a whole lot more to leave government support than to stay on it.
I'm Candy Cleaves. I'm 57, and I'm a mother, a grandmother, a wife, an advocate, an activist, and a person who lives with multiple disabilities. Around 30 years ago, I moved to Maine and very quickly realized something wasn't right. I wanted to be able to go back to work, but the meds that the doctors ended up putting me on at the time, the cost was crazy. And there was no way that I could afford to be able to purchase my medication if I didn't have MaineCare. And that became a real problem. The program wasn't set up in a way that I could go and try to get that employment and I would lose those benefits, and then I wasn't going to be able to pay for the meds, and then I wasn't going to be able to afford to drive to work or have, you know, the other things that are required to be able to have a job. And it really kind of trapped me at that point in time.
It's the same dilemma our pretend friend Kim faced. When trying to move forward ends up setting you back and making you stuck. The original idea behind social welfare was to help people get back on their feet. Because when you do that, you're going to have a stronger society. You'll have a more compassionate society. You'll have one that, you know, where everybody is growing, contributing, and flourishing. And there will always be people who truly can't work or provide for themselves. And I think we should help them. But how we help is what matters. And that matters for everybody, for those that can't move forward right now and for those who can. And somewhere in this giant mess that we've created with our welfare programs, I think we've lost sight on how we actually help. Like, what is at the heart of it? What is that supposed to look like? The Bible makes this really clear that God calls us to care for the poor. James 2 verse 16 says, "Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes or daily food. If one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, keep warm and well fed,' but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it?" We're called to act, not just to wish people well. And the way we act and care goes far beyond just the financial. It is so relational and built on godly justice, dignity, and restoration of the person. Scripture also calls each one of us to personal responsibility. 2 Thessalonians 3:10, Paul writes, "If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat." I think he's reminding us that work itself is good. It's part of God's design for how we're provided for and how we take care of ourselves. And it also keeps us from idleness, the choice we might make to opt out when we're actually able to step in. In ancient Israel, farmers were told to leave the outer edges of their fields unharvested so that the poor could come and gather what they needed for themselves. But today, we've lost a lot of that. We've lost a way to give the person that dignity, to give them work that is good for their spirit. That's what I think truly helps somebody, that real compassion that lifts people out, which restores that dignity. It helps them stand and it gives them hope for a future. I don't think we get that with bureaucracy, where people are locked into a system. It will manage their needs, but it just simply does not move them forward and out. And everybody suffers. The poor who stay poor and the taxpayer both pay the price. So what on earth do we do? That's the big question. I'm not in government, so it feels overwhelming how you even address this kind of thing. Where do we start? And I think, you know, in a perfect world, all of this care would happen through churches and local communities, not through government systems. I think that's the ideal way, but we don't live in a perfect world. We live in a fallen one. Needs are great. I'm not saying we should scrap every single program. Some serve a real purpose, but do we really need 80 of them? Probably not. I mean, do we need 45 million Americans on food stamps? I doubt it. I don't think so, especially when we see that people are not coming off of welfare. I don't find it to be healthy. I think it's pretty true that the farther help gets from real people, the less effective it becomes. Meaning, the more we move compassion and care out of the hands of families, churches, and communities, and into the hands of government systems, bureaucracy, the colder and more disconnected that all of this gets. I think it should move the other way, where we have less federal, more local, where we can see our own community's needs. Because the goal isn't just to reduce poverty. It's to restore people. And some of that is happening across the country. People are mentoring single moms and running food banks. They're teaching job skills, walking families through a crisis. But if we are going to have a government model running much of this, then I think it's in desperate need of some change. Because the current setup and system that we have does not set people free. It traps them and it's handing out aid without offering a way forward. If the goal is to help, and I hope it is, I think it is, then why aren't we lifting people up? Why are we holding them back? And it shouldn't place additional unnecessary burdens on the ones who are helping. It's broken. And part of the reason it's broken is because I think we're confused on how we define poverty. Poverty isn't just about a lack of the basic necessities, though that is a core component of it. But what can also happen from the lack of those basic necessities is that lack ends up rippling into other areas of our life that are also essentials for a good, healthy, flourishing life, which are connection and purpose and hope. And if we truly want to address poverty, we need to address the whole person. We need to see the whole person. And I don't know how well government programs will be able to do that. And if we want to make a difference on our own as a believer with our church and our communities, we can do that. Look around your community this week. Who is stuck? Who is treading water? Who is struggling? Who could use not just a handout, but a hand up? That's where I think welfare begins.